I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is the Tech Central podcast brought to you today by iOCO, the IT systems integrator within the EOH Holdings stable. Now, I'm pleased to welcome a familiar face to the show now, and that's none other than Stephen van Coller, the CEO of EOH Holdings. Stephen, it's good to see you. Are you keeping well?
I'm very well, thank you, Duncan. Just came into 2021 after a bad 2020, as we know, but at least we're out of lockdown now, or out of the really hard lockdown of level three. So yeah, Hopefully the businesses can get moving again.
Yeah, hopefully we won't be talking about COVID so much at the end of the year, Stephen. But this is actually the first in a series of five podcast interviews with iOCO on the topic of the Great African Tech Opportunity, which is going to be a fascinating subject to delve into. So Stephen has kindly agreed to set the scene for us for this series of podcasts, and we're going to have a look at the state of play of IT on the African continent, including South Africa, and where the opportunities lie. I guess, first of all, Stephen, many South African companies have had their hands burnt pursuing pan-African business forays. I'm thinking of retailers in particular, but I know there are others. Retailers in Nigeria, for example, have found the going there very tough and have come home tail between their legs, realizing that they can't just duplicate the South African model elsewhere on the continent. Do you think it's maybe easier, a bit easier, for an IT company like iOCO to make a go of it in some of these markets than maybe a retailer?
Well, I think the thing that was really different between doing business in South Africa and then doing business in some of these African countries is our infrastructure. We've got actually a very good infrastructure that works very well. And so logistics are an important part of your delivery and reducing your costs. That obviously, you know, became a problem. And you mentioned Nigeria, and there, you know, if you speak to a ShopRite, how long it took to get stuff through the ports and everything. Whereas when you get into tech and you're getting into cloud, I mean, you can have a look at MTN. They've made a great success out of Nigeria, out of Zambia, out of Ghana, out of Uganda. And this is because once the actual tech is in the ground, so that little bit of, you know, logistics to get your tech in the ground, everything else you make money out of is in the cloud, as they call it. So this is why I think tech going forward has got a much better opportunity to actually capture the growth of this next billion, as they call them. And this is why you see people like Google, Facebook, actually investing in bandwidth and that into these countries, because they know if they get that right, they then get access to another billion consumers.
Yeah. And it's not, I guess it's not as logistically intensive as a retail business, for example, particularly if you're delivering something like cloud services.
Exactly right. I mean, all you have to do is one time get your servers into the country and set it up. And a lot of the telcos have already put that infrastructure in the ground, so you can piggyback off it. Yeah. And some of them, you know, like Google, are putting cables in the ground, fiber optics. But, you know, hopefully things like 5G over time will actually get rid of that need to have it into homes and things like that. So you can see the African continent, they missed the fixed line boom, and they went straight to mobile, and that was much easier. So you didn't have to dig up ground and put cables into every home. And it looks like they will, you know, for the whole fiber to the home. So they don't have this big legacy cost. And if you have a look in rural Africa, they're all adopting solar and, you know, much faster in small scale than actually having to put, you know, big coal-fired, you know, power stations or gas generators, and then have to, you know, put up all the transmission lines, which are, you know, are just massively expensive. So once again, they're skipping the legacy. And so this is really where I think the tech industry can, you know, make a play.
Interesting. But there must be a lot of barriers still to doing business elsewhere on the continent. I'm thinking the number one must be a regular supply of electricity. And unfortunately, in South Africa, we've been having a some challenges of our own, but they're nowhere nearly as severe as the electricity supply challenges in some of the markets north of us. But I imagine roads infrastructure, even telecommunications, which has been, as you mentioned, developed quite a lot in recent years, must pose some sort of obstacle in many of the markets that companies want to operate in, including iOCO.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think the real issue is if you go back to the traditional IT business, which was really OEM driven, it's actually quite expensive, and it's been adopted by the larger corporates. And if you have a look at the larger corporates in most African countries, is they actually are multinationals. And basically what they do is they'll have a system, you know, globally, and they'll cut and paste it into the country. And so the opportunity is a lot less. But what's happening now is that with open source, with API economy, there's a lot of opportunity to drive that for them within a country into their consumers. So you actually create this B2B2C type model, and it allows a traditional B2B model, a company like ourselves, to actually get access directly to the consumer. And the consumer generally pays margin if they get service. And this is where I think you can start assisting companies in this whole everything as a service type model, if you want to call it.
It's interesting what you say about B2C and B2B. Because, I mean, we've seen companies like Facebook and Google investing in Nigeria. In fact, some of these companies have chosen to invest in Nigeria over South Africa. And I think that's a function of the fact that the Nigerian market has such a large population, and that population is also very young. So those social media companies see a big opportunity there. I imagine it's quite different, though, for a company like iOCO, which is very much focused on the business-to-business side of the IT market. Are the markets that you look at and chase going to be different to some of the big multinationals like Facebook?
No, I don't think so, because we typically follow our customers. So where our customers are going, we will follow them. I don't think we're going to go in there, and because we largely are B2B business, but we're trying to help solve the B2C problems. Right. And so we tend to follow our customers, and what a lot of them will do is they'll do something in a market, say South Africa, get it to work, and then they want to cut and paste it into their other markets. And that's really where, you know, the opportunity comes.
So, Stephen, what about the skills situation across the continent? I mean, we know there's a global shortage of IT skills, especially in certain areas like cybersecurity and others. Is that amplified in the African context?
No, absolutely. And, you know, especially where those skills can go and earn more money working in a developed market. So we see it in South Africa. I think my biggest issue is not people wanting to leave EOH. It's actually people getting offered jobs in Europe or UK, in the US, where, you know, they're prepared to pay them 30% more. And this is always going to be our problem. One thing that is changing, obviously, is there's a lot of online education now. I mean, you can basically get a university degree, you can get a UK A-levels just online. And so all these certifications and that, you can actually, you know, you can do an IBM certification, you can do an AWS cloud certification, you can do it all online. And so this is slowly catching up, but the lack of skills or the shortage of skills is, you know, a problem, and one has to address that. And so, you know, as part of our employee value proposition is actually this upskill yourself, you know, you have to, and it's part of your KPIs and for the year that you have to do, you know, so many courses, and you need to get yourself upskilled because it's moving fast.
Mm-hmm. How open do you find, and I imagine it changes from differs from market to market, but how open do you find other African countries to South African multinationals coming into their markets? Obviously, you've mentioned the examples of the big international multinationals, like, you know, companies like Coca-Cola, etc., which are very active on the continent. But do the Kenyans see South African multinationals coming into their markets in pretty much the same way as they would view multinationals from Europe or North America, or do they have a different view of us?
I think it varies from market to market, but generally, my rule of thumb is if you're going to go into a country, you need to use locals. So you can take some, let's call, foreigners as a South African into a country, but, over time you need to transfer the skills, upskill the locals, and eventually it needs to become a local company. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, the brand is, will proliferate in that country. Clearly the big brands like a Coca-Cola or a Nescafe or a Nike, I mean, they have their own global ability to, create following. But for someone like EOH, it's a little bit more difficult. So you have to go in there, you have to create a local business, you have to create the skills, and you have to, build that up over time. But, we haven't had problems where we've had to do it. In some cases, where the projects are more complex, tend to be around some of the government implementations, they actually prefer to have someone from South Africa or, someone from the UK, because they want to know you've done it before and that you can actually deliver. And just like in South Africa, they always want you to, work with a partner, transfer those skills. So one has to be open to that.
Yeah. So you still need to do the hard slog on the ground. It's not a case of waltzing into a market and saying, hey, we're EOH from South Africa. We're here to scoop up all of your IT services business. You still need to work for your crust.
Absolutely. There's no shortcut to hard work, I'm afraid.
Good. Well, we've seen an explosion of tech hubs around the continent. Not so much here in South Africa, but they're quite big and important in Kenya and East Africa, and I think a growing force in Nigeria as well. Do you work with any of those tech hubs? Do you see what do you see as being their significance in the development of the tech ecosystem on the African continent?
Yeah, interestingly, we worked quite close for them when I was at Barclays Africa, and we worked quite closely with them when I was at MTN. EOH itself, we haven't done a lot at this stage, obviously, because we've got other issues, like paying back lenders. So we haven't been able to really branch out, but we do quite a bit internally. But I think it is quite significant. The difference if you are in an African country, largely, entrepreneurism is survival. You have to do something, invent something, because it's your daily bread. Not many of them have a rich dad or a rich mom or a rich uncle that is prepared to feed them venture capital money for a while so that they can have post university a bit of a social year off. Mm. So it's actually about creating businesses, and I think a lot of the in these hubs, the government have seen the fourth industrial revolution as a way to accelerate growth in the company and in the country. And so they've actually been getting involved in it. The universities have been getting involved in it. I know MTN Nigeria actually sponsored the local university. And this is, as they try and, leapfrog things, everything being mobile and everything being online, how do you actually use that to grow the economy? And there's been a proliferation. If you have a look in Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, Uganda, and this has really been driven by the government and, making sure that it can actually work.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say there, because I mean, you look at the US, and there's a lot of wealth that's being passed down through the generations, which doesn't really exist on the African continent. And of course, in the US and other developed markets, you have a lot of venture capital and private equity money sloshing around the system, which is largely absent across the African continent. There are some pockets of it, including here in South Africa, but across the continent, there isn't a lot of venture capital money available. Do you think there's a responsibility for companies like iOCO to help invest in bright-eyed, smart ideas, bright individuals who are coming up with problems solutions that solve Africa's challenges, or do you think that the government should be the one that's running these tech hubs and helping these bright individuals to achieve more, or do you think iOCO can actually play an active part in helping fund some of these initiatives?
I think, firstly, Duncan, I don't think that the government can solve every problem. All they have to do is enable it, and create the platform for it to happen. And you can do that with tax incentives, you can do that with industrial development zones, you can do, you know, lots of things like they've done with our car industry. So, but I think, you know, a business have to see it as an opportunity. They need to believe that the fourth industrial revolution is a real opportunity. And actually the youth is the future. You know, if you think about a 20-year-old today, in 10 years time, you know, they're going to be your customer. And so you need to solve with them. And, you know, while they don't have lots of dependents and things like that. And I do think that if you can do it with the scale of a company like EOH, because we have got lots of the building blocks that we can put together and allow people to, you know, run on a test bed using our IP and see what they build. It's a bit like how the Apple iStore or iTunes store came about. They didn't know that Google Maps was going to be, you know, the biggest hit of you know, all the apps. That it just happened that it got used for location and, you know, lots of different things. And I think this is what you have to do. And it's one of the things we're building at the moment is what I call the EOH, you know, IP store or API store, that first of all will allow all our developers across all our businesses to reach into the catalog and not reinvent the wheel. So you get a lower cost of service, but you also get time to market. But eventually you want to open that up to the development community. And it's an interesting point you make, because, you know, in my sort of experience of mentoring some of these startups and being at the accelerators, what people do very quickly, they come up with this great idea, and then they do the POC, it works. And then they suddenly realize they're running a company. Mm-hmm. And a company needs a back end. It needs to do invoicing. It needs to do collections. It needs to do cash management. It needs to do HR. It needs to do payroll, you know. And all of a sudden, they start trying to put all those things together, and they forget about their idea, and then they run out of money. And I think this is the big opportunity for, you know, a place like us. I have all that already. It exists. So why can't people just camp on, you know, my instances, and we can then, you know, develop things together. So these are lots of things one can do, but obviously, you know, there's a cost to everything. You've got to make sure that eventually it becomes profitable.
I imagine the as a service model would help a lot of these smaller entrepreneurs across Africa, because they don't have to build a lot of these things, because a lot of these things are available as a service delivered in the cloud. So as long as they've got decent connectivity, they don't have to reinvent the wheel, right?
No, that's exactly right. And this is this whole partnership model that you know, everyone's been talking about. Don't go and reinvent something that's already built unless you think you can do it way better. And I know a lot of, you know, people like BCG, their whole innovation model is, okay, deal with the big companies, you want to create something. The first thing they go and do is they go and see if it exists anywhere else. And then they evaluate those existing businesses and see, is it easy to replicate? If not, which one of them would be worth, you know, working with? And are any of them good enough for what you really want? And so they always go that model first. And it's the same thing we do as we, you know, build platforms or build something as a service, as you go and see what exists. Is it, you know, fit for purpose? Is it, can you use it rather than rebuild it? The second thing you've touched on as well is, I mean, there's a two-speed economy emerging, and where multinationals are big enough, they tend to want to build and own their own IP. And in a way, they're becoming a competitor to someone like EOH, because eventually you provide them skills. Eventually they say, oh, actually, I don't want to pay the margin on those skills. I want them to come and work directly for me, and they take your people. Then you've got the next level, which I call that the enterprise level. And then you get the large corporate and the mid-corporate and the SME level, who actually want to outsource everything. This is exactly what Zara does. You know, Zara, if you run Zara's point of sales, you actually do their bank recons for them and everything, because they say they're not financial people. That's not what they do. They're very good at store management. They're very good at design, and they're very good at actually manufacturing their clothing. And that's what they want to, you know, stick at. They don't want to do the things that they're not good at. Otherwise, you end up with a mediocre service, and it costs you more. Mm. And this is what I'm seeing a lot in the sort of large corporate, mid corporate, is they don't want to run a full HR function or a full legal function or a full internal audit function. They actually want it, you know, 90% of it just done for them and managed for them. And this is, in essence, I suppose, is what cloud is. People are saying, I don't want to run my server farms. I don't want to run my, you know, data farms because I need to scale them up, scale them down, you know, whenever I want to. And actually, if you can get it on scale from AWS or a Google or even from an EOH, it should be a lot cheaper you know, better. If you think about a bank, they have these big servers and these big data farms that basically get used on, you know, every second Friday and maybe a Saturday morning and then at the end of the month. It's a bit like we buy a 4x4 because we go to the bush for 2 weeks of every year and we drive it to work every day. It chews petrol and actually all you needed was maybe a smart car or a Vespa for most of the time. Mm-hmm. It's the same concept. And we're seeing this more and more as, you know, IT becomes more plug and play, that people want to outsource more and more of what they do.
Yeah, it's interesting. And software as a service is almost designed for the African continent in some respects. And ironic what you say about big corporates, because they are desperate to get rid of that legacy infrastructure, because in many respects, that legacy infrastructure is what's holding them back. So we are seeing big banks, for example, in South Africa moving to the cloud because they actually don't want to be running that big tin that's sitting in their basement anymore.
Correct. But still, you know, with regulation there, they still have to have their own private instance of it, and that, you know, that costs a bit. And so hopefully over time, regulators will realize that actually the cloud with the security layers in it, or distributed ledger or blockchain, is actually way more secure than the current systems we've got.
Mm. So Stephen, tell me a bit about, I beg your pardon, continue that thought.
No, it will just accelerate it. You know, you have to get, you know, past that point. It's quite interesting that our government is actually under the search has actually done a lot of work in this. And I think we might be actually end up being one of the leaders in changing things like identity. You know, you don't have to go and do some historic document and historic address. You know, I'll have my phone with me every day. You know exactly where I live. You just got to go to the location map on it. So why do I need to bring all these documents? Just go and check on my cell phone where I spend 90% of my time, you know. So these are the things that need to change to take, you know, cash out the system. And now this is where I think Africa can leapfrog, because they don't have the legacy. You can just go to the, you know, next level, and that's quite exciting.
Now, Stephen, I was going to ask about where IOCA operates in the rest of the continent, and which markets in particular are you particularly interested in? Where are you seeing the growth opportunities coming from? And what do those growth opportunities look like? What sort of business opportunities are you seeing there, and how do you expect that to develop in the coming years?
So at the moment, we've got an office in Egypt, which I think is a fascinating market. You know, it's 110 million people. It's growing at 5 to 6%. They're just, you know, busy building 20 new digital cities, and they've really, you know, throwing the ball forward. But there's other markets like Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, you know, that are interesting places right now, because they are quite at scale, but they're also making significant changes. The reality is that you have to pick your sector. So in sub-Saharan Africa, we're largely doing things like banking, e-filing, ETF processing, that kind of stuff, because we've been doing it for 4 years, and we do that through a company called Cybrin. We've got some online, you know, credit scoring that we do in Ghana and South Africa at the moment with XDS, and that will, it's like an Experian lookalike, and that will be expanding because it's all mobile, it's all in the cloud, and it works. But, you know, Egypt for me is one place where we're already starting to expand our business. Just because the level of education there is as good in South Africa, and but it's still the wages are still, you know, cheaper, so you get a cost advantage, and you can also move work between the two hubs. And also Egypt's a great a stepping stone into the Middle East, which also has, you know, lots of opportunities. So we're sort of trying to sandwich Africa between North and South Africa, and we'll, you know, slowly expand in those markets as our customers move there and our customers want us to do stuff.
It's really interesting what you say about Egypt, because it's not a country which you typically associate with South African companies' expansion. But you're seeing opportunities there. Obviously, they went through the Arab Spring about 5 or 6 years ago. I take it they've, it's not a country I look at closely, but I take it they've come out of that Arab Spring and they're doing well now, are they?
You know, before that whole episode where they had the almost change in, I suppose, the government, I mean, Egypt was a very European-ish, you know, country, and it was doing incredibly well. It was just they went through this whole change, I suppose, and that ended in the Arab Spring, and they're now going back to where they were. So they've almost lost, I suppose, a decade and a half or two decades. But it's a highly educated, highly intelligent, actually very ambitious country when you go there. It was quite interesting. I actually met one of the deputy ministers while I was there, because we were, you know, just seeing how we could invest. And I said to him, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing one of the other ministers who will remain nameless. And he said to me, well, I'm not sure you can. So I said, why? So I said, well, I'm told he's getting fired tomorrow. And I said, why do you think he's getting fired? He said, because he didn't do what he was told to do.
Wow.
It was so refreshing that actually a government official has actually got a job, and if they don't do their job, they get fired. But it was just the way he said it, like, you know, he just didn't do what he was told to do or said he was going to do, so he's out.
Very refreshing.
It was like, that's what we expect.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, how cool would that be?
Yeah, indeed. let's send our cabinet on an immediate fact-finding mission to Cairo, shall we? I know, Stephen, you want to chat a bit about this concept of leapfrogging. We hear it a lot, the suggestion that Africa is well positioned to leapfrog the rest of the world because we just haven't invested in legacy infrastructure. And you used the example of the mobile sector and mobile money, particularly, and how Africa and particularly markets in East Africa have embraced mobile money as a concept. But how important is this idea of leapfrogging? Is it a cliche, or is there something really to it?
No, I just think, and I think COVID's, you know, shown it to us, is that there are, you know, the idea of working from home is not a new idea. Everyone was just too scared to implement it. And now, you know, overnight we all went and worked from home, and it's actually been generally pretty good. And you can see already that you can very easily do a hybrid of it. Mm-hmm. But we're all too scared as leaders to take that decision to allow a flexible workforce, you know, for example. If you think about education, I mean, education, proper education is the most important contributor to productivity in a country. I mean, there's been many studies on it. And it's not, you know, if you think about having a workforce that goes into a repetitive job, first of all, it gets boring, so people make mistakes, don't do it. It doesn't uplift them, and you can't pay them more. The biggest issue is that you know, we need to lift all people in South Africa, for example. We need to get better quality, but you can't do it unless you increase the productivity. I mean, my personal view is that our minimum wage is probably half of what it needs to be. But if you want to put it up to where it should be, you need to double the productivity. How do you double the productivity of someone? Well, you've got to educate them. And the beauty of it is that you can today. There's all these apps and there's all these courses online. All you've got to do is give someone some connectivity and they need to have a device. The problem is that you have to, because the government regulates schooling, they have to lead with it and say, this is okay for us, or actually for our rural schools, we don't have the time to train teachers. Let's just train, you know, people to manage, you know, kids in a classroom, and let's give them this world-class education. And that in itself will lift the economy, but you have to leapfrog a whole step. You know, you need to make it a new way of doing school. You need to actually, you know, go there first. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. You know, I think about data in the South African context is it's a national asset. Spectrum is a national asset, just like we charge royalties on mining, you know, and we give people 6 kiloliters of water free, and we give them the first bit of electricity free. Why aren't we giving them a certain amount of data free every month instead of, you know, charging, trying to auction spectrum for a few billion rand? That just puts cost into the pipeline, means that the bottom end of the pyramid don't get access to it, and I don't know where that 6 billion disappears to in the government. So why don't you just give the incumbents spectrum and tell them that they have to give every single person in South Africa a minimum amount? I mean, it's a very interesting experiment one of my colleagues in the retail bank did when he was there at Absa, is they decided to put free Wi-Fi inside taxis, and then use that to market Absa as a, you know, retail bank. Do you know what the biggest use case of that free Wi-Fi was? It was downloading school tasks.
Oh, wow.
School information. Nearly 80%.
Wow, that's amazing.
It just tells you it's needed, you know. If they've got it, they'll use it, they'll educate themselves. People want to get themselves out of poverty. You've got to allow them. You don't have to do it for them. You've got to create the enabling environment. So these things aren't complicated. You know, we can do them. We need to think about it. I mean, I think all schools should be just changing their whole curriculum and changing their way they do it, you know. My kids go to Cynstillion's because they're fortunate. And but if I was in Cynstillion's, I would be creating Cynstillion's online. And you can actually, you know, get an education from Cynstillion's, even if you're sitting out in Zanin on, you know, some rural farm, as long as you've got your free bit of data and a device. And, you know, maybe even they can, as part of logging onto the school, you pay over 12 months. But you get a, I mean, this is what I think leapfrogging is. It's just fundamentally not doing step by step. Take three steps instead of one.
Do you think corporate South Africa should be doing more to invest in these sort of initiatives? I mean, I guess the starting point, the view to start with, is that it's the responsibility of the government to educate the citizenry. But by the same token, do you think corporate South Africa should be doing more to invest in education and skills development, particularly in the tech space?
Listen, my personal view is, you know, you as an individual, as a company, you've got to do what you can do. And I find it difficult to understand why, you know, we're not investing more in these things, because if you've got a long-term view on South Africa, you've invested. I mean, we saw Ford putting in 14 billion rand into South Africa. I would put money into education around my plants, because in 10 years' time, all those people are educated, they're more productive, and they're going to, you know, add to your business. If you educate more people, you know, say you a Discovery Health, if you educate more people, they can earn more money, you're going to have more clientele. But you've got to be able to think 10 years ahead. You've got to be building a business for 10 years ahead. And the problem is that it's not often that CEOs last 10 years. So what they want to do is they want to invest. It's the whole problem with capitalism is you invest for the time that you're going to get the benefit from it. So actually, it's better for me to cut costs, make more profit. I get paid, you know, my share price goes up. I get paid more money and then I leave. And this is the fundamental problem. And I think this is where people like Paul Paulson at Unilever, you know, did this, such a fantastic job, is because he didn't do it. He knew he was going to be leaving, you know, before he saw some of the benefit of his predecessors, of his issues that he changed. But he did it because it was about the longevity of a company. And just to give you something, I mean, I was lucky enough at Davos to meet some people. I met the family owner of Lego. You know, their business philosophy is so different to a listed company, because he says, you know, I need to keep my employees happy. I need to keep this business alive because this is my family legacy. I need Lego to be here in 100 years' time. Otherwise, my family doesn't have its legacy. There was another company that, just to put it in even harder contrast, was there's a brandy called Louis Trez. It's the most expensive brandy and one of the most expensive brandies in the world. I think one bottle of it costs like 30,000 rand or 40,000 rand. But the reason why it's so expensive is that they mature the brandy for over 100 years.
Oh, wow.
So if you're running the company today, you're making product that 10 generations or 5 generations are going to sell. If you stuff it up today, you've just ruined their future. And if your ancestors stuffed it up, you don't have a life today. I mean, just think about that. And so as a listed company, you know, these people are thinking 100 years ahead, you know, to build sustainability into their business. I challenge any listed company that's thinking even, you know, 15 years ahead. Mm. And this is a fundamental problem, I think, with capitalism, and we have to get it right. We've got to think about growing our country. We need to think about, we need to have a 100-year plan, you know, and we need to execute on it, believing that we're building something for our future, for our kids. Very long answer.
No, very, very interesting insights. Now, Stephen, we've spoken quite a bit about the rest of Africa. I think sometimes we forget that we are part of Africa. South Africa is on the continent. We've got some challenges here ourselves. We have a much better infrastructure base from which we're working, but by the same token, a lot of that infrastructure is potentially legacy, whereas the rest of the continent, as you said, has the opportunity to leapfrog over that. We have seen a lot of investment going into the South African market in recent years, particularly in telecommunications and data center infrastructure. Data centers seem to be mushrooming up all over the Gauteng landscape at the moment. Yeah. So there's a lot of investment happening there, but do you think we're maybe allowing ourselves to slip in other areas? Are South African corporates investing sufficiently in IT to remain competitive with their global peers?
Listen, I think it's starting to accelerate, especially where I'm seeing. I think they've been slow. Mm-hmm. And I mean, typically, why it's been reasonably easy to do business in South Africa is because we're 2 or 3 years behind Europe. So if you go and see the trends in Europe and then you start implementing them here, you actually get ahead of, you know, what happens. And that's typically just because a lot of corporates, large corporates, if they're headquartered in Europe, will do their headquarters first and then they roll them out into their other markets. And so that's just a trend. But I think, you know, South Africans are getting better at actually managing their own destiny, and they're also starting to see that with cloud and with digitization, you can actually compete in these bigger markets quite easily. You know, we saw it with VeriSign, you know, some years ago, but we had a webinar with the guy who was the co-founder of Get Smart, and you know, that got bought by an international company, and he's now building with I think in the UK a virtual university. And so we've got all the capability, but we do need to accelerate it, and we do need to be a bit more bold in it. I find that we've been generally, and I'm generalizing, we've been a little bit less bold because we've had a short-term view on life.
Yeah. And I suppose given the political challenges we've had in recent years and the state of our economy, you can forgive business executives perhaps being a bit nervous about making investment decisions.
No, exactly right. I think it's very difficult to, unless you've got certainty, to go to, you know, your investment committee with an audacious idea, because, you know, they're going to be cautious and they'd rather save it and, you know, see how it turns out. And this is really where regulatory, you know, certainty, government speed in terms of approving things, you know, needs to come. South Africa's lucky. It's got a very big, diversified company base, I suppose. And so for our government, it's just about speeding up the enabling environment, because the corporates here will expand, will do well, are capable. There's no reason why we shouldn't be growing at 3 to 4% a year. It's absolutely no reason. Mm. Because we can, and we've got the capital markets, but at the moment we're just sitting on all the cash.
Well, I touched on the topic of data centers briefly there, and many people are now seeing South Africa as a potential hub for cloud services into the rest of the continent, and we're seeing the big hyperscale data center operators opening data center facilities here in South Africa, and those are being used to service at least the sub-Saharan African region, if not beyond. So there's clearly an opportunity in the IT space there, but what are some of the other opportunities as you see them here in South Africa? I know that people have spoken for years about South Africa as potentially being a major outsourcing destination, and there has been some of that work coming to the South African environment. Is that still an opportunity, do you think? And what are some of the other areas that you think might be opportunities going forward?
So what's interesting is with these data centers coming here, that in itself creates a massive opportunity because it allows us to have these hyperscaler cloud services very close to us. So you're not relying on some subsea cable link or something. It's here in the country. And so typically what you do is you'll have 80% here in the country and you'll access the 20% from, you know, different nodes. And I think that in itself is going to be really, really helpful. You've got the NTT one coming. You've got the Azure one. You've got AWS ahead. IBM are talking about it now. So, I mean, these are like really exciting opportunities that then create, you know, further opportunities for us. The whole outsourcing opportunity was largely to do with cost, mm-hmm. the access to skilled but, you know, lower cost. I think those things don't last for long because, you know, very quickly the demand rises and the supply is less. And so normal economics, you get the price point that then converges. But I do think that we have a great opportunity in things like application development, application services, DevOps, where we've got highly skilled people in the country who actually enjoy being here, enjoy living here. And yes, it's got a little bit more difficult over the last decade, but I'm sure we will sort that out. South Africans tend to do that. That we can actually do 70% of the work here and then export it. And we've seen great opportunity on that. You know, our cloud business in the last year and our IoT business has exploded, you know, largely because we're doing it at a lower cost. And then when we take it offshore into that sort of large corporate mid-market space, we can deliver the same thing for, you know, 60-65% of the price. And so I still think the South African IP and our ability to generate IP is still very, very competitive globally. We just need to be able to, you know, get the infrastructure and, you know, get that from government, get it, you know, continually through, you know, we're still waiting for bandwidth for how many years on the 5G spectrum. Mm-hmm. It's these things that I don't know why it's such a difficult decision. It's such a small decision, really. Just get it done because it drives the economy. We mustn't slow that down.
Stephen, it's been a great discussion and a great opening seed setter for the series of podcasts which we're going to be running with IOCO in the next couple of weeks. So look forward to those discussions. We're also going to be taking a deep dive on the Egyptian market, which I am looking forward to hearing more about in that discussion. So keep an eye on that series of podcasts. Stephen van Coller is, of course, the CEO of EOH Holdings. Thanks so much for talking to Tech Central today.
Thanks, Duncan.